it was fascinating listening to you again. You went through, it was almost like an estate agent in a way. Now, okay, so here's Mpumalanga. The worst house that you're going to be shown was first. But that's an exciting proposition, just to start off with. But you have, at the end of your talk, you did say that this was similar to those huge discoveries that we had in the past, diamonds, gold, Bushveld Igneous Complex. Just give us a sense for context of how the comparison of what South Africa has with other parts of the world, if that's possible.
Yeah, so these are significant finds. I can't give you a comparison to, for example, Saudi Arabia or one of the big ones like that. They are talking about, I suppose, close to 1 million barrels of oil a day from Namibia. Consider that annual demand is about 100 million barrels. Have I got that right? Not as much as 1 million. 800,000, I think they're talking. Best case scenario. These things demand a lot of onshore tech in that, certainly the gas does. The oil is simpler because, you know, it's 200 kilometers off the coast, so you just park an oil tanker there and pipe it aboard. But there is a lot of a lot to do in terms of establishing the wells, getting it so that you can pipe it easily to the surface, and then having tenders that you can use to transfer it to the ships. Yeah, so back to your question, it's very significant. Not the biggest we've ever seen in the world, but more significant than some other destinations, which are, you know, think of something like Angola further north, which is now fading in significance. You know, they've pulled out a lot of the oil there, which they have, and that will decline. But further south, this will certainly more than replace that, I think.
Tony Twine, the late Tony Twine, who was an economist at Econometrics, an incredible human being who was blind and yet had a great feel for numbers. He was putting he did a research on fracking in the Karoo alone, which is one of the areas that you talked about. He was talking about a massive impact on the South African economy, hundreds of thousands of jobs. He was accused of being too optimistic at the time. Was he?
I would think no. If you look at the impact that fracking has had on the US economy, turning it from an energy importer to an energy exporter, and you drill down into the effect that fracking had on the places where it has taken place, it was just astonishing. You know, there are all sorts of stories about in Texas, for example, they couldn't get school bus drivers anymore because everybody was off driving trucks for the fracking industry. In North Dakota, they didn't have the labor to unpack the shelves in supermarkets. So they just dumped pallets there and people had to get what they wanted for themselves because there were so many, low to medium income jobs created. So that sort of thing, you know, it's not just people sometimes say, oh, but, you know, there's only a few experts involved in this oil and gas stuff, which is true. But there's a very long tail of logistical support, people building pipelines, people driving trucks. It's terrific for creating jobs, which South Africa needs probably more than anything. And then, of course, there are all those wonderful revenues that roll into the fiscus, which we could really use right now. And you can see that. I mean, you know, when I say really use, that budgets are being cut all over the place. My colleagues in the Western Cape are finding that their schools and hospitals are having their budgets cut despite rising demand. It's a very difficult circle to square.
So why are you, as a shadow minister, as a member of the opposition, going into an election, giving us this good news, talking this good news when basically the ANC is saying nothing?
Two reasons. One, because I'm really interested in it. Two, because it holds out the promise of what South Africa could be. And that promise could be realized by a few fairly simple tweaks to the legislation. We could really turn it around and we could, you know, it's going to happen, I think, the extraction of these resources, but it's just going to take longer under current conditions. And we shouldn't have to wait that long.
We've got a very vibrant energy WhatsApp group on Business Premium. And one of the contributors says, all very well, but it's come too late.
No. This kind of stuff doesn't come too late. And that inherent in that question is the belief that renewable energies are taking over, which they're growing, and they're growing faster than anything else. But just to give you an idea of the scale of what is going to have to change for that to be true, Goldman Sachs said 2 years ago that over the previous 10 years, on the expenditure of $3.8 trillion US dollars, they had knocked the share of primary energy of fossil fuels down from 83% to 82%. That's very expensive, and it's going to be very, very slow. The people who make their money from this, the oil and gas companies, are projecting a shortfall of gas in the next 6 years, and that'll be the time more or less when these Namibian fields start producing in earnest, and increasing use of oil at least through to 2040. So these are not going to be a waste of time. Just another figure which may amaze you. Do you know that this year the world will use more coal than it ever has before? There was a record set 2 years ago, and they reckon they're going to break that record this year. So, you know, the energy transformation is happening, but it's going to happen a lot slower than some people want or think.
So Namibia has got a head start in South Africa. First of all, why? And is South Africa going to be able to catch Namibia and maybe go forward if it's going to be another Norway?
We won't catch them in time. But we can be, you know, 3-4 years behind them. And that may happen. It's great that that a law has been passed. As I said, it's not a great law, but it's one that, for example, Total can operate under. So I think they will go ahead with their Mossel Bay field. Even though that's quite a technically difficult field. It sits in the Mozambique current, so there's a 5-knot current all the time, and you're far out at sea, and it all makes it really expensive. It means you have to have very robust equipment. But that seems to be going ahead. So why did they go to Namibia? Because Namibia was just much easier to deal with. Namibia has had more or less the same law in place for years and years and years. There they demand a 10% of any oil project goes to the state oil company. The South African law says that you've got to give 20% to the state oil company, which hasn't yet been formed, but they want to form out of Petro SA, and then an additional 10% to BEE Business, which is great for BEE Business, but for the oil company, it's just another 10% giveaway, so they have to give away 30% of their project. So, you know, if you're going to invest in a project, do you want one where you give away 10% or one where you give away 30%? Well, you'll take the 10% one first, but maybe you then come to the other one further down the line. So that's going to slow everything down.
What's interesting what France was saying about the bayonet hitting steel. Well, clearly, in the South African industry, either the bayonet hasn't hit any steel or the penny hasn't dropped. Because if it's going that way in Namibia with a slight change to the legislation, not in South Africa, what is your reading?
The ANC is a remarkable organization. They really know very, very little. And I mean, take it from whence it comes. But I've sat on the Mining Portfolio Committee for more than 10 years now, and nobody reads anything. Nobody's aware of anything until the department comes and tells them that something's out there. It's extraordinary. And the other thing is, of course, in South Africa, the ANC very rarely meets that steel in the business community. Unfortunately, what happened in the oil and gas sphere is that when they messed up their attempt to change the legislation 10 years ago, the one steel that they did meet was Exxon, world's largest oil company, which just said, under these conditions, we will not spend a dollar until you change them. And the ANC was a bit shocked by this, but it took them a long time to back off. It took them 10 years before they got something through. And in the meantime, Exxon just gave up and left. That's the danger we face. But there is, sadly, very little steel in South African resources companies. They tend to go along to get along.
What about the recent movement of Royal Dutch Shell?
I don't think that. Look, South Africa is not an easy place to operate, but they had chosen to go in with a company which is basically a business arm of the ANC. Shell does seem to be divesting itself of its downstream assets, and that means its filling station, the filling station part of its portfolio. And of course, the downstream is that. The upstream is the discovering and selling oil and gas. And it's done it in other countries. So I think it's more a part of what Shell is doing internationally than a vote of no confidence in the South African government.
But we ran a piece this week that said sources in government maintain that they are going to punish Shell in the offshore area for what they're doing in the retail forecourts.
Twas Gwede himself who said that. Out loud. And that's, I put out a statement, which I'm sure all of you studied, which said that that is, of course, the way that Gwede runs the mining industry, which is to threaten to punish anybody who steps out of line. And it works. If you publicly fight with the ANC over their policies or the way they're carrying them out, you suddenly find that you don't get mining licenses, or that there are just all sorts of unaccountable bureaucratic delays. And nobody wants to be punished. So everybody pretends to go along with the ANC. And I'll give you an example of how this operates. I mean, I, for years, have been in mining companies being told about all the difficulties that they face from the government. And then every year, when we still had a parliament before it burned down, we used to have this sort of jamboree of the annual mining or minerals mineral resources budget, where all the great and the good would come along and watch the minister deliver his speech. And I would walk through the lobby of parliament filled with all the great and good of the mining industry who'd been complaining to me about how difficult their lives were, and yet in front of the government, nobody would know me. Because they knew that if they were too friendly to the DA, there would be consequences. So it's kind of a mafia operation, you know, and that's not a way that you may get short-term obedience, but you don't get long-term investment from that.
Is it changing at all?
Sadly, no. It's very, very difficult to get the ANC to change. They have a program that was laid down years ago, and they stick to it no matter what. No matter how much evidence you bring that it's not working, it takes a lot to turn it around.
But at least in this area?
In this area. But it took them 10 years, you know. But, you know, the great thing is it is now moving forward. There is stuff happening. They are about to take gas out of the ground, which is brilliant.
This experiment seems to be working quite well. Thank you for putting in the WhatsApp questions. I just before we go to them, James, and there's a number here for you. Where is the DA in this election? We heard nothing from France. I don't know if that was because you're in the room and he thought you would be addressing it, but it did appear as though the DA had a chance of perhaps even catching the ANC at one point. But the polls aren't telling us that anymore. How are you guys seeing it?
Pretty much according to the polls. What France described is more or less what we're hearing. But this is a feature of South African elections. We build up support in the intervening years as people can see how badly the ANC govern. But then come election time, there is an absolute deluge of attacks on the DA from all quarters, ably abetted by most of the media. The DA is a white party. The DA is racist. The DA isn't as good as it says in the way it governs, although, you know, you have to disbelieve your own lying eyes if you go to the Western Cape, because it is really chalk and cheese from the rest of the country. And that has an effect. And so our support trends down, although we will end up ahead of where we were last time. It is quite disappointing. And part of that, I mean, a large part of that, I think, is the media environment.
Explain.
Most of the media is staffed and edited by people who come from an ANC background. They may not vote for the ANC anymore, although until quite recently they did. And this affects the way they see the world. And they're very quick to jump on to the defense of the ANC, or perhaps more importantly, to attack the DA, because the DA believes in things like free enterprise and horrible things like that, which you just can't really accept. Any decent person can't really accept that, according to them. Which, yeah, it's a very difficult operating environment, and it's possibly our fault for not having tackled it sooner. But I think we will be doing so with much more dispatch in future. I hope so.
So what's the upside for the DA in this election? What would be regarded as a success? Because the way you've pointed it out to us now is a higher percentage of the national vote than at the last election.
Definitely. And quite a strong possibility of some sort of governing coalition in Gauteng and possibly even KZN. KZN is very interesting. And our party is doing surprisingly well there. And it's very difficult territory in which to operate. But again, everything has been thrown into confusion by the emergence of MK. And the important thing for with regards to MK is, and it's a continuation of a trend that's been happening, is because credible black opposition parties emerge, it means it becomes okay to be black and to vote for somebody other than the ANC. It's quite an important psychological bridge that people cross there. And I think, you know, that once you've not voted for the ANC, even if you voted for the EFF or something else, it's quite easy to then move on to something else. And just to explain myself there, there's remarkably little ideological coherence in the support bases of a lot of these parties. And I'll give you an example. In 2014, just after the emergence of the EFF, I later established that I was at that stage the Member of Parliament for Soweto constituency, the western half of Soweto. On its way to the final DA rally, one of the buses of DA supporters from Soweto had a discussion. And the idea was put forward that we're all anti-ANC, but it seems that the EFF is much stronger against the ANC than the DA. Maybe we should vote for the EFF. And I think a lot of those people did, because in that ward I got an unusually low percentage of DA votes. Those people could be, they're not ideological. They could quite easily be persuaded to change. So these voting blocks aren't fixed.
So I guess the big question is, how mature is the South African democracy now? The question that follows that is, if we were a more mature democracy, then the voters would really be punishing the poor governance that we've seen for the past 30 years, or particularly the last 20.
Yeah, we're very much still shaped by our past, not unexpectedly. And that takes a long time to move out of the system. But I think France will tell you that if you survey younger voters, their attitudes are a lot more flexible than those of the older generation.
Well, we might yet get big surprises in the elections. Nobody knows. Eshke asks, you mentioned that it would take time for gas production to ramp up. Is there a risk that global pressure moves on from disinvestment in coal to disinvestment in gas by the time that we have meaningful production?
I think very little risk at all. As I explained from those figures, coal is still huge, and gas will be very, very big for a long time. In fact, demand for gas is going to go up. It's interesting that even the Australian government, which is quite green, has just committed to a major gas project beyond 2030, much to the anger of their Greens. But they've seen the reality is that it's a great transition fuel. And the world is probably going to be using a lot more of it rather than less of it over the next 20 years.
Tim's question is, could you cover how the government's policies control access by business to these natural resources and the extent that these policies limited their potential?
As I explained, I think that, you know, when you have to give away a percentage of your project to BEE interests, you often find that those BEE interests do not have the money to fund what you're giving them. And so it adds an additional financial burden to the company investing. It makes their investments less profitable. It also means you have situations like, and I'm imagining this is what's happened with the Shell investment. The Black Economic Empowerment Partner, which is Tebe Investments, which is really an ANC business arm, has turned around to Shell and said, but we want to cash out of this. And can you give us the cash now? And Shell has just said, but the cash doesn't exist. You know, you can't have it. So there's now all of a sudden a big fight. So you get partners who, A, can't bring money, and B might be troublesome because they don't really understand the business. And that just increases the risks for anybody starting a business. And people obviously want to limit risk as much as possible.
Yeah, there was on the West Wing program a little bumper sticker, which I love repeating. It said, if you think education is expensive, try ignorance. Did Exxon not absorb most of the profits from Guyana's oil? This is from Wendy.
It may have absorbed a lot because they have a lock hold over that deposit. But the GDP of Guyana went up, I think, in the initial year of oil production by 69%. That's a lot. Now, the increases since then have been much slower. As you can imagine, it's off a larger base. But I think this year, again, they're growing something like 25%. That's, you know, so they took a lot of money, but the country got a lot of money too.
Ian asks, is it correct that in certain parts of the country, there will be more than 40 candidates on the ballot? This is in South Africa. How does this translate in a country where literacy is a problem? Why has there not been a successful coalition approach led by the DA with the smaller parties, i.e. Moonshot? And is this the problem? Is the problem, he says, Helen and Johan? I think that was probably a spell check error. He must mean John.
Yeah. Just in this regard, remember that the Moonshot Pact was Johan's idea. So he was really the moving force behind it. And it's a very good idea. You know, if you're heading for an era of coalition government, it's better to sort out as much stuff in advance as possible, which is what the pact has done. The length of the ballot paper and confusing people, look, that's always been a problem. It's made up for, to a certain extent, by the fact that you have party symbols and pictures, tiny pictures on the ballot too. Nevertheless, you know, if you're not terribly literate, you can still mess up. There's a big joke in Parliament that one of the cleverest parties was a small breakaway party in Matatiele, which wanted to be as part of KZN, not part of the Eastern Cape, which it is. So they started a party called the African Independence Congress, the AIC. And the belief was that a lot of people marked that ballot by mistake when they were trying to vote for the ANC. And they initially got four seats in Parliament because of that. And if you look down those multiple parties, a lot of people have tried to match the colors and the letter combinations of more popular parties because they reckon that can get them a couple of seats. I mean, the AIC is still in Parliament. They even made it through the last election. Whether that was by mistake or that time or because of their sterling track record, I don't know. Their track record, incidentally, was voting with the ANC, I think, on every single thing that I can imagine. So they just became like a branch of the ANC. And there are a number of small parties which are like that.
Simon asks, do you appreciate muted enthusiasm for these prospects, considering what happened firstly with the Australian company MRC in Pondoland? Then secondly, with the supposedly TFC deposit of shale gas in the Karoo. Well, I think he meant, was it 500?
200, possibly.
200 TFC.
Look, I don't know what that is. The question about communities reacting against resource extraction, and that is a big problem, increasingly so in the South African mining industry. I think in terms of gas, you will find a lot less impact. I mean, once you've drilled the gas well, you have a standpipe maybe this high sticking out of the felt, and that's it, maybe connected to a pipeline. So there's not the usual impact on agriculture or grazing or anything like that. Where it may be a problem is raised expectations from the community, people saying, but this is our gas, it's under our field, why don't we get any? And this is a problem with the effective nationalization of resources, is that it's owned by the people, but the people means the government, and the locals don't see any of it, at least not directly. It'll come back in the form of government revenues, and government may give out money for various reasons to that community, but they don't see it as coming directly from that gas field. That's something I think we should be thinking about, incidentally. We should be thinking about changing it so that a percentage of the government take goes back into some kind of local community fund. It's a very interesting area.
But they did that with platinum in the Northwest. There are a number of very wealthy groups.
Yeah. Look, the wealthiest groups, the most successful, were the people who got in first and organized themselves. But often what you find when there is revenue flow back to a community is it's very difficult to decide, to define what the community is, because there's no kind of legal definition. So you'll find somebody who's parents came from that community and have lived in a city for two generations coming back and trying to claim it. And then often what happens is there's an election of people to represent the community in terms of how to spend this revenue. The election is held. Some people think that they should be getting more, so they form a breakaway group, typically called a concerned citizens group, which then starts fighting the other group for the revenues. And you end up with huge community conflict. So it's very difficult to manage that too.
You'll feel the air conditioning is coming right. What happened was they had to reset it, so thanks for your patience on that one. Jermaine says, fracking has a bad rap in environmental circles. Have the problems with water contamination been resolved? And if not, what mitigating policies will be put in place to ensure this damage is avoided?
Yeah, we've always said that, you know, if you're going to frack, just do it properly. Don't cause a bigger problem than you're solving. So there was water contamination in the States when they started fracking. That was before they had general standards. And, you know, just remember what happens is when you frack, it's pretty deep. It's not like the shallow gas that I'm talking about. You're going down generally maybe a kilometer and a half to get underneath the shale, which is trapping the gas down there. So you go through the water table. And what the safety standard says, if you sleeve that initial part of the well in concrete or steel or both, you stop the gas leaking. And it's in the interests of the drillers to do that, because nobody wants all the gas that they want to take out and sell to drift into the water table. So they're quite good about doing that. So there hasn't been a lot of water contamination. And that's, as I said, the great thing about 10 years of fracking in the US. Apocalyptic predictions, which just haven't come true.
Josh wants to know, do you think the Biden administration proposed increase on tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles and solar panels is an acknowledgement that the climate crisis is not as bad as reported? This could add to the positive nature of the aforementioned oil and gas fines.
I'm not sure that governments are that smart. I think it's probably more to do with trying to manipulate relations with China. But even so, I mean, I'm a bit of an electric car skeptic. I think if you look around the world, there's a couple of things which should be warnings. Tesla sales are down 30% of the last year in Germany. Tesla's just sent a senior executive to China because car sales are down. The boss of Hertz got fired. It's assumed for overinvesting in electric vehicles. So yeah, it's great tech and they're wonderful and everything, but don't expect us all to be driving electric cars in the next few years. I don't think it's going to happen.
As a South African, you're not allowed to say that. You know, we do claim Elon Musk.
We do, and he's wonderful, but he does lots of other things, not just Tesla. You know, I think there's going to be an energy mix. The whole net zero drive founders on one simple thing. And that is that there are simply not enough metals being mined to support the changeover. Not even close. We would have to mine by 2030, I think. No, it can't be. Anyway, the next couple of decades, as much copper again as has been mined in human history to try and meet that demand. And it's not happening because people aren't opening copper mines enough. And this whole thing with Anglo and BHP shows one of the reasons why. It's difficult to start mines. BHP would much rather acquire copper mines which are already functioning. And there's, you know, any mining is more and more difficult because of green opposition, if nothing else. Is that any mine gets opposed by the Greens, any mine gets tied up in the courts beforehand. You have to be very, very careful about meeting very stringent environmental requirements before you can mine. And there's mines in South Africa where people can't raise money, but for reasons of it being South Africa and mining policy being poor. So we've got copper sitting there as well, which I would love to see take off. But and it will happen one day, but when that one day is, I don't know.
Dirk says, I'm curious about private capital investment opportunities due to the gas fines in Namibia and perhaps by extension in South Africa.
Well, I could, I mean, that the Australian company I talked about, Kinetico, is a private company. They're quoted on the Australian Stock Exchange, so look there if you want to invest. Namibia, I'm not so familiar with, but it's interesting that the American-based company Rhino Resources, which has been looking onshore in South Africa for quite a long time, and they have, as I said, some acreages in the same area as Kinetico, have just announced that they're going to drill with an Angolan partner off the coast of Namibia. So everybody is piling into Namibia, boots and all. Chevron too, they've just quite recently, and I think BP as well. So there's a gas rush.
That's an incredible stat though of Kinetico, 44 wells, 44 hits. As and, you say, it's
and nobody knew it was there.
And the averages are more like 10%, you were saying.
Well, that's offshore. Okay. I don't know what the onshore average is. But yeah, it's brilliant, and it's relatively shallow. I mean, if you're finding good gas at 250 meters, that has huge implications for how expensive it is to take out.
John wants to know, he says, the world acknowledges that the future of electricity generation is nuclear, with the peaks and troughs of demand smoothed by natural gas. South Africa will have the natural gas, but where are we on increasing nuclear generation?
Nuclear is difficult in South Africa. Even if you like nuclear, which I do, I also don't want the ANC government to be doing any large nuclear builds because they'll just steal the money. So that's the kind of thing that interrupts what we're doing. They are moving forward. I mean, there have been some hiccups. The current big nuclear project is to renew the boilers at Kuberg, which Eskom has stuffed up, and it's taken longer than it should have, but is now being done very well. And I have that from somebody who works high up in a European company who's actually on that project. He says the Eskom team is now very, very good. I think at a stage it wasn't, and that was a bit of a problem. But anyway, we have to get over this hurdle before we start talking about new nuclear. And of course, the last push for nuclear was under Jacob Zuma, trying to get the Russians in with a ruinously expensive project, which fortunately fell by the wayside, I think to the anger of some Russians and the possible bad consequences to some ANC people involved. But yeah, you don't want to be in business with the Russians is my takeaway from that. I think nuclear will come. There are plans for it. But again, the timelines, I don't know.
James asks, your namesake, when committing long-term capital to cyclical projects, you have to have a margin of safety or certain required rate of return. When you add additional risks to the project, you increase the required rate of return for that capital allocation decision. Okay, I'm with it so far. As policy uncertainty is part of the component of risks in addition to BEE, royalties, localized components, etc., is South Africa at risk of missing out entirely as required rates of return eventually exceed the project's potential? And I think that's a really important point because we've got these wonderful opportunities which you've explained to us. But there are a number of obstacles which maybe tip the scales the wrong way.
I think the fact that we still have some mining investment, although not nearly enough in South Africa, shows that really what happens in that equation, which I agree with completely, is that you just have to price in the risk. So your project has to be much more bankable in the first place in order for you to embark on it. It doesn't mean you stop. It just means that a lot of the lower hanging, the less profitable projects just get cut out of the equation. But stuff will always go ahead. Are we at risk with missing out? Well, yeah. We missed out to a large extent on the resources boom that ended with the crash of 2008. We've missed out on a lot since then, but those minerals are still there. They won't always be required, but they still are. So there's a good chance that they will be taken out. Slows everything down. It stops us making the most of our resources. And that's a problem with the kind of levels of poverty that we have. So that's very disappointing and frustrating. But it doesn't mean that that is not, it's so close. That potential is so close that you can taste it and need so little to turn it around, which is what one of the difficulties of my portfolio is just seeing the stuff just there, but we can't quite get there. So any little nudge that one can give to the ANC in that direction is a payoff.
Bring on the steel. About 2 years ago in Davos, Namibia had a very good presence. South Africa, just about nothing. And Nigel's question is a really good one. He says, Namibia is investing heavily in green hydrogen. And I saw it there in Davos telling the world community. What are the prospects for this in South Africa?
A lot of talk. And there's some people who are looking at it seriously. But nothing so much on the table at the moment. There's still a lot of skepticism about hydrogen. And I'd love for hydrogen to work because that means our platinum industry will flourish. But there's still some respectable people who say that the technical difficulties of the hydrogen economy are just too high and they cannot see it working. I suspect that it will work, but whether it will be the silver bullet that ends all our energy problems, I tend to doubt. But I think, you know, like everything else, we'll get a bit of it. It'll be part of the mix, but not the only thing.
Isn't it amazing, though, human ingenuity keeps surprising us? Maybe this is the next big surprise. Last question before we go for tea. Graham says, are there not issues around Renergen and their LNG find in the Northern Free State, i.e. what they supposedly are extracting is not what investors were led to believe? You did mention Renergen in your talk. Have you got any insight on that?
I don't. I'm not. Renergen are quite, in my experience, difficult to talk to. But look, I mean, remember that they were there as primarily a helium company. I mean, helium has a lot of technical difficulties as well. You have to get it out and you have to get it to market within 44 days. And from the middle of the Free State, that can be quite difficult. You know, it's not easy to transport, and particularly with South Africa's transport infrastructure failing like it is. I think they've got a good resource. You know, they are producing some natural gas as well for their customers. That is not the main purpose of that business. That's kind of a nice to have. The helium, I believe, has started coming out, but they're also in part of the company cycle, I think, which demands huge expenditure for not much coming out. And people don't really like that. It's not a particularly happy stage to go through, but most people have to go through it first. So I have hopes. I even bought some shares, which I'm keeping, and I hope that they'll go up.
You lie? Oh, I suppose you just. I hope you disclose.
I disclose everything. They're not. I always worry a little bit that my disclosures will invite scorn because the amounts of money involved are so small. But it has been a good. Compared to the ANC, they've got real disclosures when they make them. It has been a good discipline to me to understand the market more. When you have a couple of thousand invested in a share, you take an interest in it and you follow it much more closely and you get to understand more about the mining business by doing so. So I have a good defense.
James, thanks for breaking with your pre-election diary and schedule and for joining us here in London and sharing with this audience today the insights that you had. James Lorimer, thank you. Thank you.